Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Gedrimas Jeglinskas. Als Vorsitzender des Ausschusses für nationale Sicherheit und Verteidigung im litauischen Parlament hat er eine einzigartige Perspektive auf die geopolitischen Herausforderungen unserer Zeit. Litauen, das direkt an Russland und Belarus grenzt, steht im Zentrum der geopolitischen Spannungen, die er mit klaren Analysen einordnet. Im Rahmen der DLD-Conference in München haben wir über die zunehmende Bedeutung von Verteidigung in Europa gesprochen, über die Lehren aus dem Ukraine-Krieg und über die Frage, wie Europa seine Sicherheitsarchitektur effizienter und einheitlicher gestalten kann. Gedrimas hat dabei betont, wie wichtig ein gemeinsames Bedrohungsbild und gezielte Investitionen sind, um Frieden und Stabilität langfristig zu sichern. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Gedrimas, I'm so happy to meet you here at DLD to talk a little bit about defense, about the situation of Lithuania and everything that like kind of keeps you awake at night. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Daniel. Great to be here. First time at DLD, but yeah, looking forward to this conversation.
I already said like you are in a geopolitical, very exposed and important and also interesting and yeah, dangerous situation and location at the moment. And you just announced that you are planning to spend 5 to 6% of your GDP on defense. So for us here in Germany, we are always like trying to pretend that defense is not a big issue. It changes a little bit over the last couple of years, obviously. But before that, we've been living in a situation where we all thought like war is over forever and like it's the end of history, to quote Fukuyama, but that changed a lot. So you've always been living in a situation where it has been quite clear that there is a risk, there is a danger. How did the whole situation change over the last couple of years, if you look at your country and how you deal with all those topics?
It's a definitely a comprehensive question, but I wanted to quote something just for you, something that came in the morning, and I think that's very relevant to what I will say and to relevant to the whole geopolitical situation. So overnight, and we're recording this at the DLD on a Saturday morning, overnight, there were 4 ballistic rockets, Iskander, and 39 Shahed drones launched at Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. Air defense worked well, but still we have 4 dead, 3 injured. Now, to me, that's a vivid example of what's going on, that, you know, Ukraine is at war, but not only Ukraine is at war. Ukraine is that, you know, they're stopping the advance of the, as we call it, Mordor state, Russian state, to the expansionist state, the revanchist state, to sort of reclaim their sort of its imaginary territories. And we knew it all along, of course, in living in that piece with we're sort of in between Russian Federation, Belarus, when Belarus, of course, we consider as really a vassal state of the Russian Federation. It's not really an independent state. Yet we are part of the EU and part of NATO, so we are, you know, we're confident in our defense. Yet I think the realization has, you know, is pretty stark that we are at war, that Europe is at war, and we need to do whatever it takes to really to ensure that deterrence works. And I think that's I think we oftentimes I kind of misjudge, you know, what defense and deterrence is. I think it are very much connected concepts, but let's say, so deterrence did not work in Ukraine, but because it's a vast territory, they're able to defend themselves. They can retreat. They can then push back on the Russians that have done it very successfully. Really, I think I think we can only see that Ukraine has been brave and bold and heroic and also very successful in defending against the Russians. Russians still have not achieved their strategic objectives. Ukraine is even more inclined to join the Euro-Atlantic community, whether it's EU or NATO. So I think, you know, I think there's been a lot of successes that Ukraine has done. But, you know, going back to the defense and deterrence concept, we in Lithuania, again, a small parcel of land there in the eastern part of Europe, is essentially, we cannot even think of that deterrence cannot succeed. We have to make sure that deterrence succeeds. Now, that means we need to invest in our defense. Now, the statement that we at the State Security Council just made a couple days ago, yesterday morning, that we're going to go to about 5.5% of GDP for defense starting next year is obviously a bold statement. So it's, I think it garnered a lot of attention from the media in news outlets. I think it also comes with a responsibility to develop our forces, to develop a defense capabilities, and also to ensure that our defense really capabilities are not only ready to fight the current war, but are ready to fight the future war, that are lethal enough, that have technological advancements sort of integrated into our armed services, whether it's, you know, drones is sort of like everybody talks about drones these days, right? But it's not just drones. It's a whole, you know, disruptive technology suite of technologies that with AI and autonomy and big data sort of calculation, perhaps in the future, you know, there'll be some quantum systems sort of involved. So it's a massive file that, and we know that we need to invest. Now, I think also this 5.5% of GDP sends a very clear message both to our people that, you know, we're ready to do whatever it takes to defend ourselves, but also a signal to allies like Germany, like France, like the US, that, you know, we're serious, we're going to invest. And I think we're kind of pointing to that, you know, you mentioned that in Germany that there's debates about the need to invest in defense and how much you need to invest in defense. I mean, the whole of Europe is underinvested it. To your point, in the world of Fukuyama's words, the end of history, well, end of defense investment. That was kind of the mantra that has been followed. We've been following for almost 30 years now, and I think that has to change. It's the war is real. The war that we're kind of fighting in the West is West and East. That we're not part of those countries that are not part of you. They're not Ukraine. Is really the hybrid cyber disinformation, but also increasingly so becoming much more kinetic. We've seen sabotage acts, we've seen diversions, we've seen the cable cutting right in the Baltic Sea, despite the fact that Baltic Sea had become really with Sweden's and Finland's entrance into NATO is a truly NATO body of water. But, you know, there's things are happening, and I think the Russians will not subside until they really rebuild their influence, as Putin said, to the kind of empire level. So we need to hold together and we need to invest in defense.
So we had kind of a discussion lately in different podcast episodes before this one about where to spend defense budget. Because if we look at our German Sondervermögen, then a huge part of it didn't go into European defense companies, into European defense tech, but in US defense tech. So what's your take on that? Should we try to strengthen our European companies, our European defense industry?
I'm absolutely positive we need to strengthen European defense, not for some strategic autonomy purposes, but purely because we need to have a proper defense. Now, given at the investment levels that are being made in Europe versus the US, and if you look at NATO numbers, so it's, you know, I'm kind of approximating these figures, but NATO countries spend about $1.5 trillion worth of their currencies for defense per year. Now, about a trillion of that goes to the U.S. Half a trillion is everybody else, 31 countries. Now, if you look at the EU countries, because you have to take out the U.K., Canada, Turkey, and then you get to the true EU numbers, they're about 360 billion. So that's 2.5-3 times almost less than the US. So I think the capabilities that US forces have are unmatchable at this point. And it's probably, even if we spend, I don't know, billions, hundreds and hundreds of billions more now in the next decade, we're not going to get there because it's just, it's been, you know, we haven't done it for forever. We never, ever since the founding of NATO, ever since the end of the Second World War, we never have invested. And if we remember, you know, everybody's talking about it, Donald Trump talking about how it is, or Europe needs to pay for defense. Yes, but President Eisenhower and every president since Eisenhower from the late 50s have been talking about that Europe is not doing their share. Now, Donald Trump came with different rhetoric, different style, different kind of carrot and stick approach. But I think without the U.S., we cannot survive. Now, having said that, I think the ball is in our court in Europe to really fund that defense. Yes, we need the jets, we need the air defense, we need certain long-range intelligence capabilities that only U.S. primes and U.S. companies, not only primes, but really the new emerging new tech like Anduril, Palantir, and others have. But let's look at the European market. It's such a fragmented market. So even if you're, you know, as I said, 1 trillion is the US, half a trillion is everybody else. Even if we double our defense spending, the efficiency of that spending is likely not to be the same as in one country, because it's all 31 countries. They all want to subsidize the national industries. They want to, and by the way, it's not wrong to subsidize the national industries, especially in defense. But the point is that because of the lack of scale and lack of funding at the moment, I think that to see the really successful prospects for European defense is very hard. But doesn't mean we should not do it, of course. I think there are some great examples. Helsing is becoming sort of pan-European player, a German player, but again, it's become pan-European. There's some others. But again, at the end of the day, it's the top line of the defense sort of departments in each country to allocate that money. And, you know, we're going to go to 5.5%. Imagine if every European country goes to 5%. That's a major boost. That's a major boost. And I think looking at our whole European competitiveness or lack thereof, as Draghi's report has pointed out, perhaps this could be an interesting, perhaps good way for Europe to regain its competitiveness by investing in defense, because defense investments eventually lead to other sort of benefits to the economy. So it's a complex picture, but I think, again, Europeans are, you know, we got to start with the top figure. What do we want to invest in defense? Because we need it. We need those investments. And then I think all that going to kind of percolate down and trickle down into different companies, new the innovators that will emerge, and they will, you know, they will get the funding. So it's a complex picture, but it starts with a top line.
The fragmentation within Europe you talked about, we also have that in our individual defense strategies. Wouldn't it be a good idea, and I know how complex and difficult that is, but wouldn't it be a good idea also to show strength to non-European countries and big players like China, Russia, also the US, to have a more united European approach on defense and to have like a proper European defense strategy that is like kind of one picture we are presenting to the outside world?
I agree. Ideally, in ideal setting, yes. The question is, how do we get there? I think, first of all, politically, if we look at both the European Parliament elections that kind of displayed a little bit of that fragmentation, as well as looking at all the national elections that are happening, I think at the moment, the push factor towards a more centralized, united Europe is gone. There's a lot more pull factors that pulling Europe apart, whether that's, you know, Hungary or Slovakia kind of trying to veto sanction packets and kind of putting certain, you know, negative statements for the unity of the European continent, or any other, in every country, there's a force, there's a political movement that are a lot more isolationist, I would say, and more nationalist for sure, and less institutionalist in terms of a European unity. So we see that political shift in Europe. Now, and then on top of that, now what we're trying to do, and von der Leyen, President of the Commission, von der Leyen has done, established defense commissioner post. Good. I think, again, it's 10 years too late, but again, that at least we have it. But that's almost runs counter to the whole political vibe shift, if you could say, in Europe. And that's, of course, that transcends borders. That's, you know, that reflects what's happening in the US, in Canada, and everywhere around the world, really. I think this is not where Europe is not unique by any means. But unity starts again where we can actually find a common threat perception. If we all agree Russia, China, Iran, North Korea are a threat, I think there's some glimpses of consensus on that. Again, some countries are differing within there. So again, to reach that full-fledged consensus will be hard. And then once we have a clear threat perception, clear threat picture, how do we respond? And that means, okay, so what can EU do? Now, there's a talk about a $500 billion SPV, kind of special purpose vehicle for defense. Great. As I said in a previous answer, we're kind of half a trillion behind per year. That's per year. So we need $500 billion every year to be kind of matching those figures that the US is doing. Again, not to match US, not for some sort of parity with the US, but really for our own capabilities. So, you know, we have proposed when a bunch of other kind of senior policymakers proposed the idea of a defense bank, something that, you know, I think, you know, again, something to me is quite ludicrous when the European financial system, which is so advanced, so sophisticated, seemingly, they're not funding defense, right? Some are already shifting, like Scandinavian banks are kind of shifting their portfolios. But again, it's still a focus on ESG. My question is, what is ESG? Governance, I know the G is a governance, but are we defending democracy perhaps? Perhaps, you know, is that part of our governance systems, broadly speaking? I think it is. So let's not be afraid to fund, you know, weapons, because we need those weapons. Ukraine needs weapons. We need to restock our stockpiles. There's so much that needs to be done. And I think that the lack of financial markets cohesion, because there's really no single market in defense. There's no monetary union really per se. There's a monetary, but like there's no fiscal kind of balances there. So it's a challenging question, but I think we need to solve the complex things. And I think where European Union can help is really, for example, motivating the European Investment Bank to be a proactive investor in defense. We talk a lot of with EIB and different banks in kind of through our own government setting. And what we hear is that the European banks are waiting for a signal from EIB that yes, invest in defense is good. It's a good investment. It's not gonna reduce your credit, your sovereign, your rating, your sort of a credit rating. And EIB was just AAA institution. I think if they were to act, they were to invest first deal, we do have some deals that we're offering them to participate in. Those are from a credit perspective, from a financial returns perspective, they're fine, they're government guaranteed. But we need that political shift that's still not there in Europe, because there's still some countries who come in and they're like, no, we don't want defense. We only dual use, not even dual use. Like it's still quite an unfortunate picture. But I think we're slowly but moving in that direction.
In another episode, we just discussed a study, like a cross-European study about the youth and how young people are looking at war and the dangers of war. And one of the many results out of the study was that the majority of young people in the countries that kind of participated in the study is expecting a war in Europe, like in Central Europe, within the next years. And at the same time, the majority of young people said that they are not willing to defend their own country. What do you think? What is the... And there are kind of shifts between countries that are far away from potential crisis regions or like potential threats compared to countries that are closer to that. You are kind of very close to it. What do you think? What is the situation like within Lithuania with the society and the willingness to defend the country?
Yes, so I think the Economist published a couple of weeks ago the graph where they look at the correlation of defense spending with the versus the distance of the capital from Moscow. And I think it kind of starkly showed, well, obviously it showed that the closer you are to Moscow, the more you're willing to spend more. And I think that if you were to measure the sentiment in the public, both from the young and the old people, the older kind of generations, you'll probably find a similar pattern. Now, having said that, I always want more. Like when we in Lithuania say that we're ready to defend, I look at the numbers and I'm, you know, there's a, for example, we have a conscription that's been reinstated and there's still people trying to kind of either avoid service. There are big numbers, but I want those numbers to be minimal. as much as possible. And I think that the readiness of the population is there. I think we understand the threat more or less in a quite unison manner. Like, it's probably very different from in many other kind of deep Western countries, because we're there. We see it on TV every day. The security discussions and the defense discussions and questions that arise every day. Of course, now if you look at every country, including Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, or Poland, which is right there, the border of Ukraine, what has changed since the beginning of the Ukraine war, kind of for you on a daily basis? The economy keeps on growing. Life is getting better. The price is going up. It means, you know, things, the economy is expanding. Inflation, there's a, but overall, the sentiment of war is sort of hovering above you. But do you really feel it on the streets of Vilnius or Warsaw or Berlin? Probably not, right? Probably it's unless you really have some, if you take some extra effort to look into the news. And that's where I think the responsibilities of leadership come into play. I think the political leaders need to be very clear in their communication that, look, this is not a joke. The real fight is happening in Ukraine. And, you know, we're like in our scenario, we're next. Perhaps Russia's not going to be in Berlin, but the way of life that Europe will be shifted to because of their Russian victory will be unimaginable. Russian victory in Ukraine would mean that it opens hands for President Xi Jinping to go for Taiwan. It opens all sorts of weaknesses that it exposes the weaknesses that we have in the broader international rules-based order. It all changes, really. It changes the kind of America's perception, Western perception that we don't have patience in the West. We don't have patience. We don't have resolve to go back to help Ukraine win against a military power like Russia, but economically I think the combined economy of Belgium and Netherlands, that's the economy of Russian Federation. But somehow they're able to turn on the war economy, and they're able to produce more tanks, four times more tanks than everybody, the whole of NATO, which is half of the global GDP. So there are some dichotomies that are very hard to square off. And I think it's something we all need to be talking about. We all need to be aware. But the Russian victory is not just a loss for Ukraine, and we close that window. This is it. It's done. They lost. It's not going to be over, because the whole geopolitical ecosystem will be destabilized, and we're going to feel it through all sorts of things, prices through the raw materials, the kind of power projection, and it's not going to be a better world. It's going to be a much, much worse world.
I think it was Benedikt Franke yesterday on stage who said, like, we are kind of basically living two lives right now. One where we are saying that everything is going worse and we have to fight and we have to defend democracy and the free world. And then we are not doing anything, like at least big part of society. And then we are living another life where everything is just as normal as it has been like 10 years ago. What kind of warning signs, or what has to happen that we finally realize that we have to change something and that we have to become more active to actually defend our freedom?
Well, that's, you know, we can go to some horrible scenarios of what can happen and what might happen, what had happened in the past. And we know very well. If you look at the history, you know, when did the U.S. get into Second World War? Only when Pearl Harbor was bombed, right? Then, so when did the U.S. sort of start tackling the terrorist networks? Only when 9/11 had taken place. So there are some, you know, I think perhaps it's a human nature that we don't act appropriately, or we don't precede anything before something happens. So we need to act preemptively when life is good, as you say. The streets, the cafes are open, the coffee prices are going up, you get €5 latte, right? Life is good, you know, people working on the laptops, you know, it's life is good. Innovation, he has a DLD, you can see that's the thing, the glimpse, look at that. It's a bustling, innovative event where the young and all generations come together, and it's fantastic. Now, what do we need? Now, yeah, what's required for us to kind of start thinking about, you know, something that's so dark in a way, such as war? And I think without a crisis, without a proper, that's an unfortunate thing. You know, that's, we're not going to be able to act, you know, on time and in a sufficient manner. Now, again, I think that's where the politicians come in. The politicians who come in with their vision, of course. Now, politicians who probably argue for increased defense spending because, and that means you need to balance the budgets, you need to perhaps sacrifice some social spending. Of course, the populists from the other side will emerge and will say, look, no, we don't need anything for defense. We need to give everything to pensioners, to the roads and to other sort of social economic things. Yes, so, and that's the kind of beauty of democracy. We can debate these ideas. I hope the kind of people who are transatlanticists, who are defense focused, who kind of focus on broader geopolitical stability can win this debate. But there is a risk, of course, in democracy that, you know, we're going to be sort of drawn into that side where defense seems to be not the most important thing. There's a risk. And until we get, unfortunately, some real crisis, real sort of conflict approaching us, it's very hard to move. But once, you know, we've seen in the past when you are threatened, when you're hit with the first hit, people mobilize very quickly. And Ukraine has shown that very well. The support for NATO was, I think, less than 50% for the whole of time in Ukraine. Now it's closest to 90% because, you know, their sheer existence is being threatened. So I think populations can mobilize very fast, but it seems to be that there's also sort of some sort of event that needs to kind of trigger that. Hopefully that event does not have, you know, big sacrifices, big lot of deaths or anything. But it seems like it's very hard to do that without that kind of event. It seems like that's human nature. I don't know.
Like, there has been a time back when Russia escalated the war in Ukraine, when we discussed the risk of Russia invading other countries like Lithuania very vividly and very intense, like right after the beginning of de-escalation in Ukraine. Now we are not talking about that so much anymore, especially in Germany. Pretty sure that you are discussing that very intensely. But what do you think? How did the situation change within like the last probably like maybe 2 years? Is the situation better right now with a reduced risk of Russia doing anything stupid, basically? Or is the risk actually the same as it has been like 2 years ago?
I think, of course, Russia is preoccupied fully with the Ukraine. They call it operation, war, invasion, aggression, and you know, all those terrible things that they're trying to do. You know, the numbers of the Russian troops are record high. They keep on building the army to fight in Ukraine. They're not winning. Of course, they're not winning. They're pushing through now, but their Ukrainians are fighting back, and they are using the technologies and weapons that the West is providing. Of course, we're too late and too small in our support, but that's, you know, that's a separate discussion. Now the question is then, when the Russia is preoccupied with Ukraine, is there, you know, is there really a threat to others? I think the next 2 years we don't see that likelihood that Russia is able to reconstitute to do anything kind of militarily from a kinetic standpoint against anybody else, whether it's a NATO country or not. Because simply just the sole focus at the moment is Ukraine, where they're not doing well. They're using now North Korean troops. They're using Iranian drones. This is the economy that has been kind of lauded as something that has transformed and very successfully. It's not really. That's propaganda machine. We see interest rates at 21% from the central bank. That means inflation is probably running at similar levels. This is not a good picture. And, you know, there's certain, you know, there's a, you know, nobody knows, but I think there's a certain likelihood that, you know, they're not going to last that long, and they desperately need to get out of those sanctions. But again, they're not going to tell you that. They'll say that we're strong, we have accommodated all the changes that we had to do, and we're, you know, we're successfully doing this. Yeah, that's economically. I think what Russia will continue to do is running all sorts of hybrid hybrid, that's, I would put everything from disinformation, misinformation, fake news, cyber attacks. That's hybrid. Could be attacks like, GPS signal jamming. That's becoming very prominent. Then next to hybrid attacks, we see those sort of semi-kinetic attacks, whether it's sabotage, the diversions, cable cutting, I mentioned before, even some sort of explosions that we've seen in certain factories, some real kind of kinetic work where people actually might die through that incident. So that's going to increase. That has been increasing in the past 2 years. And here again, the whole intent of the Russian Federation is, and again, oftentimes they're being aided by the Chinese authorities or other kind of, I would call it the quartet of chaos countries. And the whole intent of that is to cause instability, to show that the institutions cannot be trusted, to sort of cause some sort of, societal paralysis that, raise doubts that the state cannot, successfully intervene. So really just seeding the distrust in the society, that's the main purpose. And of course, sure, to kind of tilt people towards not supporting Ukraine. And I think that's been very clear in the past 2 years, and that will continue to grow. I think that's our assessment. I think the kinetically is probably next 2 years is they're too preoccupied. But again, the intention of Russian Federation remains to, as I said, rebuild their imaginary empire, whether it's Russian Empire or the kind of Soviet Union style, country, and have that satellite states and, kind of influence around the proper Russia where it is. So our job is to ensure that this never happens, and again, that's where we need to stand together as Europeans, as transatlantic sort of union with the new administration in the US as well.
So yeah, it's always just difficult to talk about hope in that context, but let's hope that we are making the right decisions over the next couple of years, and pretty sure that you are doing your part in taking care of that. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, well, thank you. I'm optimistic. I think peace through strength, the kind of the slogan that the Reaganist slogan that Donald Trump is bringing back, I think is a sign of hope. I think, paradoxically to some, I believe that the new administration in the U.S. is still the decider of many things regarding security in Europe. And Donald Trump's presidency can bring really great stability to the global system if it's done properly. So I think there's a lot of optimism, there's a lot of excitement. And if we work together, from Ronald Reagan's strategy against the Soviet Union is very simple. It's four words: we win, they lose. So let's hope for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.